Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
broad, peaceful view of chemistry. Now, imagine chemistry is a job you're doing, and you're going to a job, you've done the interview, you've decided you want to do it, there's lots of great benefits of doing it, and you turn up. Now, I just realised that the first day, if you speak to people who are really involved in their jobs, they start to tell you lots and lots of detail, and you get overwhelmed, and you don't know about the different departments. I've had a sort of things, experiences like that of going to a job, and the first 2-3 days is overwhelming as people tell you lots and lots of information. Your mind gets overwhelmed, and eventually you work out, oh, here's the company directory, and this, the mail room, if there's an old mail room, this does that sort of thing, and here's the IT department, it does that sort of thing, and there's a group that's got characters and stuff like that. And it's sort of that meta, broad thing that you get to understand. And then people inside it have this understanding, but this understanding becomes a subconscious understanding. And they still talk to you about the details and procedures that they go through. So too is with chemistry and a whole of other areas where after you teach it, there's sort of like a valley you go through, a complexity valley you go through. You start off with the very light version of things, the brochure version of things, and as you go, and there's nothing wrong with it, you descend down a valley of complexity, of understanding and taking information together. And obviously you lose as you walk along. You start off with 10 people, and you one by one, they fall by the wayside as you descend this complexity valley. But I'm just saying, out of this complexity valley, you can go up out the other side and actually stand up on a mountaintop and look out and see beautiful, broad concepts. And so this is one of the things that I suppose I've been going through, is having been knocked off my path for a while and then getting back onto it and just letting bits of my psyche go through and just absorb and go out and tackle it, sort of memorize all the different elements, the structures and stuff like that to go in. I get enthusiastic, but I feel that I'm possibly that enthusiast person who befriends you on the first day when you're at work and tells you all the very detail of their particular area of work, and it's not necessary for you to feel at home for being at home in a new position. And so sort of consider this a sort of a more friendly tour of chemistry. Your first day at work may not be, or at least you're listening into how the first day is described. So rather than go into all the different elements and things like that, I'm going to assume that you know certain things, and then talk about sort of general departments. Now, we have to start somewhere, and chemistry involves chemicals, and chemicals involves different types of atoms, and those different types of atoms, as far as chemistry is concerned, is called elements. An element has a particular atomic number, or a particular number of protons determined. An atom can have any number of protons, or up to around 92 protons if it's uranium. Can have any number of protons up to 92 or 100 or something a little bit beyond there. And then that is the key, determines how it behaves. So it's sort of like the cash carrying in. You walk into the city, you might only have $1, so you can only buy sweets. If you've got a lot of money, you go up to an investment bank, and sort of it determines how your character and behaviour. So that's an analogy there. And so we're just going to leave it there and say that all these elements are arranged in a periodic table. That's a historical system, the way the company is arranged. And that's periodic table is basically almost an accessible array that you can look up and see where everything is. And it's a language, if you like, which allows people to talk to each other. So if I say F, I mean fluorine, it allows you to connect a whole series of different information together. So I can say F has 9 protons in it, a charge of 9. It's got an electron configuration of a particular point. It's a, sort of a, like a clearinghouse, a home address of a particular atom, a chemical atom, and that home address is determined by its street number. The street number really is the atomic number, the number of neutrons, or sorry, correction, protons involved in it. And so we're just going to leave it like that. And there's a whole lot of structure in that. So different parts of that periodic table are likely candidates, and we'll be able to come back and visit that. Again, this is the aim of this is just to give that overview from the from having descended down the valley of complexity up to the viewpoint, the sort of peaceful viewpoint, the Mount Fuji, Mount Kosciuszko, or whatever it is, where you can survey a vast landscape of information. So I'd sort of like to say the periodic table is sort of like a car park, and the cars have got a number associated, a number plate associated with it, and by Jove, you can sort of see that the cheaper cards, the lighter cards, are at one end, and then the heavier, more sophisticated cars, the gold cars, at a different end in that car park. Just to get that idea in your head. But this is chemistry. That's just one aspect. That's the language, the organization. You're going to a gig, so to speak. The next is really the chemical dance. And what happens is that you can imagine a tent coming up and these chemicals going for a dance. And you can have so many atoms of one type and another type. And they go in the tent, and you can look at them, and certain ones holding hands, other ones are not. And as they hold hands together in a certain way, form a certain way, that is called a chemical. So it may be two hydrogens and an oxygen, or four hydrogens and a carbon. They may hold hands together like that. And so in the tent, there's a certain number of atoms of a certain type, and they hold together, forming certain chemicals. And then the music plays, and they can move around and dance, and you can come back and you can see that they've changed partners. And this process is called chemical reaction. That is, chemicals come in, dance, and chemicals come out. But you've closed the tent, and at the end of the day, the people who have paid, or the atoms which have paid, are still there. No atom is created or destroyed. Now, what this means is that if you had a giant set of scales, there's the mass of those chemicals will stay the same because they've just changed partners. But moreover, so there's conservation of mass in a chemical reaction, see the dance of atoms. But there's also a dance, there's also the fact that as you take the fire manifest, or the actual list of what atoms there, the same atoms are there before and after. That's a subtly different story. That's conservation of matter. Matter doesn't have a number. It's got actually a technical description. And the conservation of matter is just saying that there's the atoms you started off with are the very atoms you end up with, but they've changed partners, so to speak. And so there you have it. There's chemistry in a nutshell. You've got the periodic table, which sort of tells you there's only certain types of atoms, or as far as chemistry is concerned, there's only a certain amount of atoms. And then you've got the tents, where the chemical reactions dance together, and they start off going in as couples, they're little swingers, they come out as new couples together. And each sort of coupling is called a particular chemical. So H2O and H2O2 are different chemicals. They're holding together at certain hands. Now, we want to move a little bit further on. So we can just say, well, that chemical is a, it's got, say, two girls, two boys in it, but it may be different. Rather than particularly tell you a particular type of atom, I'm just going to say let's spice it up a bit. Two boys, two girls, two women, two men together. Different ages together, just so they're just categorized together. But the two boys are absolutely identical, and the two girls are accidentally, everything is absolutely identical. But then we can sort of ask, why is that so? And it determines on how the dance partners hold each other, and we can start to delve into that. So it goes off on two levels. For any particular chemical, it's got to be able to hold each other it holds each other by the exchange of electrons, which we'll say there. So an atom has protons and electrons, and a chemical has the same protons and electrons, but it's in a more favorable position. The electrons, rather than actually staying with their original individual atoms, are more content or at a lower energy, can pop to a lower energy if they actually move over to a chemical, an atom which wants it more. And that atom which wants it more can sort of lower the energy of the atom which has taken it away. And so this is the overall structure. The way that it does it, the way that it can channel through it, determines the shape of the chemical. And if electrons are just like coins, which are just passed between people, if I pay you 20 cents or a dollar for something in coins, and I'm a coin less and you're a coin richer, well, that's not going to keep you standing in front of me in a particular angle. So the idea of electrons as coins which pass is not there. But if there's something else, they're a force field, they're a, I'm trying to think of something which would describe it, because there is really no physical description that we have in our big world. So I'm going to say a force field, a glowing blanket or vehicle that you get into, which sort of positions where you are and positions where the partner is, and it's sort of bound to your shoulder, so it points in a particular direction, and the other partner is bound to the shoulder. It's sort of like a big piece of cardboard which goes over the top of you, and you can fit through these shaped holes, and it puts you in a particular position. It positions and orients you and spaces you across. The electron does so much. Now, it's not something that is really accessible by an explanation. So hidden in this vista where you've climbed out of the valley of complexity onto this mountain, having a generalized look, there is still this lurking complexity in there which you have to sort of accept or appreciate as the true beauty and majesty of nature from this viewpoint. But it's something that you're not going to get from sitting on the other side of the valley of complexity. It's this thing that the electrons are shapes, and they are large, and they don't have surfaces and all this type of stuff, and they have a direction in it. And this overall direction gives you the shape and size of your molecule. It means that the methane has hydrogens at the points of a pyramid, a triangular pyramid, and they're like that, or carbon dioxide is straight. It's because the electrons themselves are a shape, and this is something that we'll just touch on. We'll just say, look, that's quantum mechanics, and that's something that going down the valley of complexity is not all that bad. It is consuming. It's hard work. It's like the Kokoda Trail. This is a trail which is burnt in Australian mythology, so to speak. This hard trail, and you go there, and yes, the trail takes you down from the naive simplicity, down a valley of complexity, and up to this viewpoint. But it changes you. You have new insights, and the electron is no longer the coin that it was, the naive coinage, which a trade and I win, I lose. It's not a profit and loss statement. It's actually so much more. It's actually a shape, a binding, some sort of it's quantum mechanics. It's a wave function. It's a complex number. It's a three-dimensional distribution. It's I don't know. It's sort of like the closest thing. It's not a cloud, but it's not got individual little cloud droplets in it. But it is a cloud, and what it says that if the cloud descends over me and it's pointing in a certain direction, you have to walk into that direction to stay within that cloud. It's a thing to say. So this is something we will put aside. And so this is in terms of the chemical arrangement, it's got to make sense in terms of where the atoms can be within it. But then there's other things, which is the cost of a atom going from what it is naturally to what it is inside the chemical reaction. So, let's look at sodium chloride. And sodium chloride is something that chlorine has, or sodium loses, or its electron moves away from it. But the important thing is the electron, there's these books of numbers which you can go through, like a form guide, a racing guide, or a footy guide to rank your teams about how they go and who will play where and stuff like that. But it sort of is like they give you the information of the people running on the beach by themselves, but it doesn't say how they will perform in a race. So sodium's an example of that. There's a thing called ionization energy. It's the amount of energy, joules, the amount of money you have to pay. Everyone is aware of energy, how much you pay for petrol. Paying for petrol, you pay money for chemical bonds. That's what you're paying for. You pay money for light. If it's made from a coal power station, you're paid for so many chemical bonds. Each chemical bond is a cost. But you can buy a guide which tells you how much to remove an electron way out to infinity. So Na, sodium, goes to sodium plus an electron. Well, yes, that's a certain amount of energy, but it's sodium plus an electron at what distance? So at the distance of infinity, a sodium plus an electron is the ionization energy. But that's not the energy you have to pay to go to a sodium plus an electron moved to the distance of another chlorine atom, or moved into a beautiful electron holder of water around it. So sodium plus an electron. So one of the tables, one of the form guides is the amount of sodium, it's called the ionization energy, and those energies are quite substantial. But they are quite substantial because it's the energy of moving an electron away. And now, why do I say this? Well, people don't normally say it. When they're talking to you about the naive view and the view going down the valley of complexity, the ionization energy, they're not interested in telling you this overall awesome life experience. So you've sort of seen a film and you sort of sum up things, and things make sense after seeing a film. But you must have seen a film, and you must have said, oh, look, the device of that plot there, they showed us that the things where you're involved in the story, to actually see how the story is put together is here. So that's what I'm trying to do at the moment. So ionization energy, very important, But it's a big number, but it's not as big as you think going in. In fact, it can be quite a small number if you move the electron a little bit away. If not a huge distance away, it's a little bit away. You still have to put energy to move it further and further away. And there's sort of two things in a ionic solid, also in a liquid, the energy is slightly different. And in fact, there is a whole sort of equations, another book for moving the ions apart in liquid water. And that's another sheet of energy levels, different from an ionization, and that's called the galvanic potential. So what they say is sodium goes to sodium plus an electron all in water. And that has an energy, but that's not its ionization energy, that's the energy in water. That's a very important thing, because you have another thing of chlorine goes chlorine plus an electron, chlorine atom plus, well, it's hard to say, chlorine atom plus an electron, but just making it fairly simple here, goes to chlorine minus. And that gives out energy, but in water. Now, the two energies go together to give you the net production of it. So there's another thing called an atom, a neutral atom plus an electron, gives out energy. Now, the important thing is that is an electron moves into the center of an atom. That's pretty much what it is. There's no reduction tables for that, because the electrons can't get closer to the center of the atom than being in the center of the atom. And when I say an electron is in the center of the atom, I do actually mean the very center of an atom. An electron's got a wave function. The wave function exists through the nucleus. It doesn't go, oh, this is too hard, I feel really embarrassed about it, I secretly love classical mechanics, so I'm secretly going to really, really wish hard that I actually don't pass through the nucleus. Electrons don't understand your prejudices about classical mechanics. Electrons float smoothly and uninterruptedly without prejudice through a nucleus. In fact, one would say that the nuclear charge must reduce a little bit in the center as you go through it, because the nuclear charge is distributed, so it's probably even a little bit stronger. There's a little bit more than you think. The most common place for a helium electron, most likely position of a helium electron, is at the coordinate 0, 0, 0. The same coordinate in which the proton is. The proton has got a size, those all the protons, it's actually big. It's an important thing to think. But it is true that electrons plus a neutral atom stable. So I hate to tell you, F minus is a stable entity. And you say, well, there's no reason for that to be there. The answer is, well, it is, if you get this impression of electrons as being shapes and you can see through it an orientation, you can move those electron shapes and see a positive nucleus from an angle. And if you can get your electron from the angle and get it in close enough and push it through, that electron will release energy. So F plus an electron goes to F minus, releases energy. The maximum amount of energy released is with chlorine. Chlorine is the king of this type of stuff. Now, there's a different thing there. That's one sheet. So you've got two sheets to compare. One is the reduced ionization energy, that is where the electron doesn't go too fast, plus the electron affinity gives the energy release when you put sodium and fluorine together. So it takes energy to remove an electron from sodium. It takes less energy to remove it a short way, and if you remove it a short way and it winds up going into fluorine, that's a minus. There's another group, so there's groups of equations for it. to do it in water or in any particular liquid, you need a new set of equations to do it, because you can actually remove the electron, but not quite, because the electron can flip. There's a polarization field. This is sort of something so intense there. But this final frontier, you can have these vistas here. So what I'm not doing is I'm not explaining incredible detail here. The electron affinity is the energy put within to add an electron to an atom. And in fact, you can add two electrons to an atom. That atom is unstable from a distance. But if those electrons are sitting on top of each other, they can actually sit in there quite well. So you can have an O double minus ion. If you kick the electron off a little bit, it will race away, i.e. there's energy you have to put over its Coulomb barrier, but it's got sort of a crater of stability up the top. So yes, so if you'd like... fluorine by itself is sort of like, or chlorine by itself is sort of like one of those pit skate parks you walk to. You walk to it and you can suddenly just throw a teenager down with the teenager's just the electron. But say O to O minus. So O is a skate park. You throw the teenager down and it forms something like a little mountain then, because that minus will repel. But you can put another O minus up there, but you just have to push up that slope and you can still push it in there. There's a limit to how much you can push in. So there's that aspect in electron affinity. The other thing about electron affinity, where the beauty is that you can see not the trends in a periodic table. It is the repatterning of the periodic table. The periodic table patterns appear again and again in each block. If you look at the S, D, P, and F blocks, you can see the pattern. It's not a trend, it's the pattern. The pattern of the S block is the pattern of the D block is the largest pattern. The P block is condensed and the S block is condensed even more. You can see the pattern as you go across and down the period, and the most intense change in electron affinity happens at low periods, the first period of everything, but it also is something there. You can see it. So the fact is, people love to say, there's trends in the periodic table. This is how you get your answers. And people go over and over. And I see this appalling thing of people drawing a trend line across my most beautiful... I take it as my own personal garden, the electron affinity. Because why do I take it as a personal garden? Because when I talk to people, they walk... I know I'm unpopular, but they walk away. They say, I haven't heard it. I haven't taught it. I'm walking away, but I just say, please go to the dynamic period table and click on electron affinity and look at the different electron affinities there. Now, that's not all. We've done the various things, the ionization energy, the not-so-ionized energy, that's what I would call it. There's the ionization energy, which is bloody well doing it. There's the not-so-ionization energy, where it's ionized enough to get to another atom. Then there's electron affinity. There's another. There's all these tables and books to see how things go. There's the electronegativity. This is when I have an ion, you know, one electron's going across to another thing, what dipole it is. And there's simple maths which says this is a very effective tool. And there's a dipole number which you give. I think fluorine's got 3.98. I think so. That's just out of the top of my memory. It was supposed to be 4, but 3.98, when it all came out of the wash, it's an arbitrary number that someone's picked up out of the head, why they picked up 4, and it gives the electronegativity. So if I add any two elements of the periodic table together in an ionic crystal, I can tell what the dipole is. If I make a dimer, which is a two-atom thing. So if I make a dimer of sodium chloride, I can tell you how much the charge is pulled across. Now, what there is that there's this sort of peacefulness as you look at the quantum mechanical structure, at some of the features going across, and then there's sort of two other stages forward. There's the stage of putting the actual not full quantum mechanical supercomputer calculations, but you can start to see a combination of the book numbers, those pages, the ionization energy, the not so ionization energy, the electron affinity, the electronegativity. You start to put those numbers together with a bit of your sense of the structure. And something which is exquisitely structured is the complex structure that you get once you start playing around with carbon and organic molecules. It becomes incredibly structured. And so you can see the electronegativity pull electrons right through an entire, like a domino effect, right through an atom. And you can see also the fact that it's structured there. They've got the chemicals ready to dance and move across. So there's that view there, that next level. And there's a level beyond that, is where you actually can just plug away and do the supercomputer simulations. Now, sort of like in the factory your first day, you talk to anyone that seems so involved, but really the information flows in this big, beautiful way. So I hope this is a good podcast. It's my best attempt so far, and I'll attempt again to do it, because the information is all there for the taking. And this is one of the things, having been a quantum physicist and then actually, and I've discovered the world's smallest molecule and one of the largest molecules, a few exotic molecules, and I've done it through this process and sealed it off with spectra, synthetic spectra, and supercomputer calculations. So I've been on this journey, and I've gone from naive down the complexity valley up to this beautiful thing, and I'm very happy and content in this era of chemistry. Chemistry for me is not standing up and convincing anybody. You know, chemistry, I haven't achieved chemistry but because I can teach other people. I've sort of achieved chemistry because I can look at a molecule and fall in love with a molecule. Say, that is a beautiful molecule. And it's something I'd like to share. And it's sort of like in any hard journey, you do have to go down that complexity valley. It's just going down a bush track. It seemed just hard yakka. That's what we call work in Australia. It's hard yakka, mate. That's probably a bit of old English, the old Australian hard yakka. It's just knowing that there's a view at the top. So all I'm doing at the moment is just showing you a little sign, dusting off a shine and saying, spectacular view up this dynamic track. You'll see canyon systems, you'll see tablets towering, glittering skyscrapers, you'll see all of this, and beautiful seas and mists and stuff like that. You'll see all that if you go up this hard track, and I just hope that it motivates you. I didn't know what I'd see at the other end. I sort of had a general sense of the power and beauty of it all, but I hope that you go along this track and share with others the experience and the beauty of chemistry.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.